the spirit of the times was hungry for this kind of revelatory and ecstatic music. And we played the hell out of it.
Clarinetist Richard Stoltzman looking back to 1975 when he and the members of Tashi recorded Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. Well, you gotta say, he has played the hell out of a lot of other things since then, and he's had his finger on the pulse of the times for decades. I'm Kathy Fuller. Richard Stoltzman played the very first clarinet recital ever at Carnegie Hall. He's won the big Avery Fisher Career Grant, 2 Grammys, and millions of fans over the years. And as much as he's feeling surprised by the arrival of his 75th birthday, he was even more surprised by the new box set of his complete RCA and Sony recordings on 40 CDs. I sat down with Richard Stoltzman to talk about the recordings and the people who have changed him. CD 13 features something by Bill Douglas. It's called Feast. Bill Douglas.
I met him in 1964. He was a bassoonist at Yale, and we played together for 3 years while I was there at Yale. And he then went I don't know where he went, actually, but we ended up together at the faculty of the CIA, California Institute of the Arts, in their openings thing. And we're there together and having a great time. I had one student, so I had a little extra time. And he and I started playing together, bassoon and clarinet, and then piano. He played piano. And he wanted me to do improvisations, but he wanted them to be in a kind of a modal vein. And so he taught me how to sort of free myself up from the classical notation and just get involved in the dance.
Wow.
Yeah.
He played a very big role.
He played a very big role at the time. And the other thing he constantly would chide me about is I would say how simple the music is that he's written, you know. And he said, well, the problem is when I wrote the music that I wrote at Yale, I brought it home to my mom, and she said, Bill, honey, your music gives me a stomach ache. So he decided that that was a clue that he should go in a different direction. So he started writing in this more melodic way. And I said, well, it's this, you know, it's great, but it's so simple. We don't really need to rehearse it. And he would say, no, I think you need to play this interval with more poignancy. What are you talking about? You know, it's just the interval. And what he brought me into was the idea that the greatness, the tenderness, and the emotional impact of music can be simply your awareness of the melodic intervals in what you would normally say is, well, that's a simple song. No, is it simple? No. Not.
So you went on to make what everybody called the first crossover album.
Yeah.
Have you been haunted by that word, or
no,
are you okay with it?
I've never been haunted by it, but it wasn't a word, actually. I mean, there wasn't a crossover section in the record stores.
This is 1986.
Of course, there weren't any records, right? But, well, no, there were.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But it was something that felt, as soon as I started doing it with Bill, natural. And we would play, we were out there at CalArts, not doing much of anything. We played for some retirement homes in Pasadena. We played some concerts there, and we would play, you know, some Brahms, because Bill was an excellent pianist, and he wanted to play some of his tunes also. So we would play Brahms and some maybe Bernstein or something, and then we play one of his. And people invariably came up after the concert, you know, I like your Brahms or your Schubert's nice, but that, what was that other tune? I like that a lot.
From that CD, Amazing Grace, which really people will always associate with you. It is so touching. It's hard to say why it's so poignant, but it makes you cry. We all wish we had that kind of long and secure breath and we could still say these sad things with it, you know, and somehow you say them for us. And I think we'll always appreciate that from you. Richard Stoltzman. It's another recording, another piece on this by Bill Douglas, which I love. It's called Clouds. Just so beautiful. It floats. There you go, floating again.
Yeah. You know, I would be remiss if I didn't say that Jeremy Wall, who was actually a student of Bill Douglas at Cal Arts, he ran into us as we were walking down Broadway around in the upper 70s or something after he'd left Cal Arts, and we had to. And he said, "What you doing?" And he said, "What are you doing any more Bill's music?" And I said, "Well, no. You should make a record or something." And I said, "But that's not classical. RCA's, I'm signed up now with RCA to do classical music, you know." So he said, "You should do this." And so I brought Bill into RCA's offices and asked Tom Shepard and asked him if he was interested in hearing something that wasn't like classical music but was very beautiful. And he said, "We have to be careful of our labeling, you know." He said, "You're now becoming an RCA Red Seal artist, and is this good? Let's not mess this up with some kind of cross ideas about..." I said, "Could you just like get that studio for half an hour and just listen to Bill? You know, I know you don't know Bill Douglas' music," but so we did, and we played for him. He sat quite a far distance away from us. The studio A was huge, but anyway, I couldn't tell what his reaction was, and we just played. We played Clouds. We played some Begin Sweet World. We played Morning Song, you know. He said, "I want to do this. I want to do this. But we can't put it on RCA Red Seal." So he said, "I'll come up with a name for a record company." And he called it Skylark. And this was the first record on that label, which didn't last that long because people liked it so much that he didn't have to disguise it as something not...
Well, that was a good way for him to find out. You did that perfectly. Well, Leonard Bernstein, they'll be the big centenary next year. He will be... it will be the 100th year since he was born. And I know you did this cool thing. You took the clarinet sonata, which is such an important piece for clarinetists, and you decided it would be nice as a as a piece for clarinet and some sort of orchestra. And what happened when you asked Michael Tilson Thomas, who was so close to Bernstein, whether you could do that or not?
Well, he said, no, the estate won't allow for any kind of reissuing of his original music. But he said, you know, I'm on the board of the trustees or something. And I think if you, I'm not sure if Sid Raymond is still alive, but Sid Raymond did all of the arrangements for Lenny, call him. And so if you could get him to go in on this, I think they might accept it. So I found out he was in Florida. He's sort of semi-retired or something. I called him up and I said, you don't know me. And I said, would you consider taking this sonata, the very first thing that Bernstein wrote, and turning that into a piece for clarinet and chamber orchestra or something? Because I know when I've played with pianists, they always say, ah, this left hand and all this stuff is not really pianistic, you know, it's something that needs to have like bass in it. So he said, well, I didn't even know that Lenny ever wrote a sonata. I said, well, it was, you know, 1942 or something. He was still in Harvard. He said, oh my gosh. Just before my time with Lenny. So he said, well, send it down. So I sent it down to him, and he responded and said, I can make something very simple. I won't do anything to alter the notes at all or anything of it, but I can make it with a string orchestra, a piano, and a tasty little bit of percussion.
There's so much of so many things in that piece, aren't there? Like it's foreshadowing West Side Story.
Yes.
There's a little Stravinsky.
Yeah. There,
you know, it's great stuff.
And he was like 18 or 19 or something,
oh my
you know.
God. I'm so glad you had that done.
Yeah.
And that's on the 26th CD of the 40 in the new big box of Richard Stoltzman recordings. Is it true that when you were little, your dad found you with his clarinet hanging out the window?
Well, no, my mom did.
Oh.
My dad was working. But I found the clarinet, which my dad, you know, he became a businessman, but he always longed for the big bands. And he would play when I was very little. He used to play Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster recordings. He had a tenor saxophone. And he would play that in the kitchen, you know, and I'd just sit underneath the table and listen to this. And Lester Young, too. He, in fact, his name was Leslie Stoltzman, and he always loved it when he had a buddy who would call him Lester. You know, he'd say, oh, yeah. So he had a clarinet, because in those days, if you were going to play in a big band, you had to do the Glenn Miller route or something. You had to be able to play clarinet and saxophone for the big band. So he'd kept it there, but nobody ever called him. And I found the clarinet and rolled it around on the floor. It's like little pieces, you know. It's sort of fun. And then I figured out how to kind of take it over to the window. And I don't know what I was doing about that. I'm not sure what that was about. But anyway, my mother said, no, Richie, no. And, you know, instead of, like, punishing me, I think my dad decided, well, we'll wait a couple of years and I'll buy you a metal clarinet, rent a metal clarinet, and you can have some lessons at the music store down in, we lived in San Francisco, Sherman and Clay record.
I didn't know there was such a thing as a metal clarinet.
Yes, I didn't either. But I have one. I still have it.
You still do?
I do.
Wow.
I do. And this is too long as another story. No, I can't go into these stories, but anyway, yeah.
So tell me how you met Manny Axe, Emmanuel Axe, the great pianist.
Wow.
He's just always been there in everybody's life, it seems.
Well, I don't know. I can't remember. I really can't.
He just appeared.
I can remember lots of nice dinners and huge repertoire of jokes and a very jovial kind of spirit of, you know, happiness.
Sure stays with you nicely in this recording. He's just right there.
You said it. Yeah, this is the one I think I always do Schubert arpeggioni. And he said, oh, I think I know that one.
Yeah. But this is the Weber Grand Duo Concertante, which is really full of notes for the pianist.
It is. That's why I very rarely play it. I mean, Bill, I love Bill, and he was great playing with me, but this is not something that he would want to do, you know. And so I tended not to play this except with virtuosos. I mean, Irma Vallesthio was another wonderful pianist who I did this with, and Richard Good.
You have good taste in pianists.
Well, I have good luck.
1987, you did the CD with Woody Herman's Thundering Herd. How did that come about?
That was a fantastic moment for me because my dad had always hoped that, he could play in a big band, but he never did. And he liked that I was in music, but he didn't want me to be trying to make a living in music because I remember he came my folks lived in Cincinnati at the time, and the Cleveland Quartet played Brahms Quintet at the Cleveland Institute, at the Art Museum maybe. Anyway, and they came up, this was probably the first time they'd ever heard me play with a classical group, you know. And my dad and mom were very nice, and they said it was really, we liked it a lot. I could see my dad was like, what are you going to do with this? You can't, what's this, you know, what's your life going to be like? Unfortunately, he died before I got this opportunity to play with Woody Herman. If I had told him, Dad, I'm going to be playing with Woody Herman's big band, he said, you made it. You did it. You really did it. You know, he would have been ecstatic. But as it was, I was ecstatic for my dad, and it was fantastic to work with Woody.
Stravinsky Ebony Concerto. Sometimes he sort of falls into this circus mode, you know, and you don't know where you're going or what meter you're going to be in. It's such great stuff.
Well,
God, they play well.
It was so thrilling to do this on tour. We did like two years of bus tours. That's how you tour with the Woody's band, and off and on. And, the band, it was so great to work with this band because they were all pretty much young guys, and they all had the knowledge that they were playing with this legend, Woody Herman, and they knew that the thing that meant the most to Woody was this piece that Stravinsky had written for his band. And so, boy, did they study this piece. I bet they could all play it from memory. They really knocked the hell out of it. And then we got a great recording. We did the recording in Studio A at RCA, and I remember when we were touring and we were playing a piece, and Woody was trying to convince me or my manager or something to, could we just get by without the, say, get no harp, no guitar, no, there's a French horn in the, because we'll save a lot of money if we don't have to bus these people, you know. And I said, Woody, we can't, this is like Stravinsky, you know. And so when we recorded it, I told the producer, turn the harp up extra loud.
That's great.
I really want that to be heard.
Oh, it's a great recording. Also on the CD with Woody Herman's Thundering Herd, Richard Stoltzman, there's a piece called Cousins. I want to ask you. I remember kind of hanging out at New England Conservatory with some of the jazz guys. And I, as a pianist, one of the things that struck me was that they were always talking about sort of the size of the beat. Like the beat was this big thing that you could live in. I mean, you could be at the very top of the beat, you could be in the middle of the beat. You know what I'm saying? And I think we think that way, but we don't out loud think that way classically. It's a different way to think. But does playing jazz rhythmically change everything?
No, but my wife Mika really says it best. She says, "Dick, you got to play more with groove."
So
and groove. She would always say that, "Dick, you know it's good. Everything's fine, but no groove, Dick. Groove."
So how do you find it?
Yeah, how do you find it? Well, you have to listen to who is the heart of the groove, and that's almost always the drummer.
Nice.
And she introduced me. Do you know who Steve Gadd is?
I remember seeing him with Paul Simon, One Trick Pony.
Yeah.
Four sticks.
Well, I never heard of him, and she still married me eventually. But in the
even
beginning,
though you didn't know who Steve
she
Gadd.
Stopped in the middle. I remember we were driving down Mass Ave with Christian Science thing, and she made me pull over, and she put a CD into the car and said, "You have to listen to this," you know. And I'm listening, and I said, "Oh, okay, what?" You know, she said, The drums. I said, "Okay, you know." And then, so she had to really educate me about this sense of the groove and how the flow of the pulse and the attention to the play of the pulse within this, you know, groove or exact. I always loved that with Woody. He would like this. He'd do this, like, and then, or something. Yeah. And then go,
and then the explosion, right?
You know.
Yeah.
But he would just give, this is a, you know, you'd say, "Oh, is this a metronome?" No, this is the groove. And we're going to play in this groove. So. What am I talking about?
You know, so often in music, it is one person who sits you down and says, you need to listen. Here's how you need to listen.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that was, you know, I think it's one of the great things about Marlboro was because everybody could play great and everybody could play, you know, perfect and things like that. But you could, to find the groove. Nobody said groove, but you learned that from playing with Mieczysław Warszawski, for instance.
The great pianist.
Great.
And I should say the Marlboro Music Center is one of the great schools, sort of incubation place for great music chamber playing.
And to hear Mieczysław Warszawski or Rudolf Serkin, for that matter, or other of the musicians who their blood is completely and their whole essence is in the music of say Brahms or Schubert or Schumann or Mozart or something, and they have it so ingrained that they're playing it as if the composer's whispering in their ear, you know.
Yeah,
this is
how
it goes.
I know them.
So they have this groove,
yeah,
which is really more an essence of the rightness of
the rightness.
How the phrases go, and that would be
applies to all music, I suppose.
It sort of does, you know. I mean, yeah,